This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Siberia had been the Soviet Union's most forbidden place. It was a place where Russians had been sent to prison or into exile or to their deaths. My guest, Frederick Kemp, took a 5-week expedition across western Siberia into areas few, if any, Americans had been allowed to visit in modern times. The expedition he was part of included several other journalists and environmentalists. They traveled along the Ob River, which is about the length of the Mississippi, stretching from the mountains near the Mongolian border to the Arctic Ocean. The expedition ended 3 weeks before the Soviet coup last August. This was Kemp's 12th trip to the Soviet Union. He's been a foreign correspondent for Newsweek and is now the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief. His new book, Siberian Odyssey, begins with the observation that Siberia has always been more a warning than a place.
Well, it entered my psyche when I was a child. My father is a German immigrant, and he would say to me whenever I misbehaved that I would be sent to Siberia, so it already entered my psyche as some place that was forbidden, a place of punishment. And then over the years, you see different images, Solzhenitsyn, the gulags, you see the oil men cutting through the ice to get to some of the richest deposits in the world, and it all lodges into your memory. There's another side to it as well, and that's political. I've always thought, since I started studying the Soviet Union, that Siberia was a place we didn't look at enough because it has most of the Soviet Union's, former Soviet Union's, raw materials, because it's such a rich place. It really is the place, if Siberia doesn't work, Russia is not going to work. Because Siberia didn't work, the Soviet Union didn't work. Or partly because of that. And so I was also looking at it as the place not only of Russia's nightmares, but also the place of its opportunities.
You write about one of Stalin's mass graves that was unearthed by an act of nature in 1979, and you pass through the town that this grave was unearthed in. What happened in 1979?
Well, it was the spring thaw, and the river is frozen in some places more than 6 months of the year. And during the spring thaw, huge chunks of ice head down the river. And this was on a bend of the river, a very, very high bank. The embankment was about 15, 20 feet high. And these ice chunks hit into the bank of the river, and it's a very sandy bank all the way up the river. And over the years, that kept churning into the river, until it finally reached a mass grave where people that Stalin had assassinated, his enemies, the people were buried. This was a great embarrassment at that time to the regime of Brezhnev. They sent tugboats to the site. Rather than reburying the bodies somewhere else, they just put the tugboats on reverse. They started churning up the water, and the bodies just cascaded into the river. And in the book, I saw this as perhaps a little bit too obvious of a metaphor, but it really was a metaphor that these bodies were coming out of the bank the way truth started coming out. And the system that was built on the lies sort of crumbled like the banks of this river. And it really was chilling to stand there and think of what was there before, and absolutely no monument there. In fact, when I went there, three boys were lying on the beach burying each other in the sand and absolutely oblivious to anything else that had been there. And the only thing there other than these boys was garbage.
Well, apparently one of the people in the area wants to build a memorial there, but others continue to use it to dump trash.
Well, that's sort of the story of Siberia, as I found it, and I think it's the story of Russia, is that you have individuals, they were called whitebirds where I went, individuals who are fighting against the burden of their history, fighting to start up new companies, fighting to reform the educational system. But you have really the bulk of society that's either resigned, a great deal of alcoholism, a society that has been beaten down for so many years that's really quite ill-prepared to take on the challenges of democracy and the free market, which of course requires a great deal of energy. And I walked away from this trip really asking me, can this person who's trying to build the monument on the banks of the Ob, in other words, can people like him overcome the lethargy and the resignation of society at large?
I think that one of the recurrent themes when you were traveling through Siberia is the sense that there are cities and towns built on bones.
Yeah, it really, and not only built on bones, but that people are oblivious to it. In Vorkuta, a city in the far north, the last stop of my book, and it was a city created by Stalin because he found coal there. But 100 miles above the Arctic Circle, you're not going to find many people who want to work, and so he sent his prisoners, the political prisoners as well as common criminals, and they populated Vorkuta. The city has hospitals built on top of mass graveyards. It has a sewage treatment plant built on mass graveyards, but people have become just so oblivious to it all, sort of desensitized to it.
How much of the population throughout Siberia is there as a result of the prison camps under Stalin?
There are three types of people in Siberia, or maybe four. The first are the native peoples, and there are 35, 36 different nationalities, ranging from Nenet reindeer nomads to the Khanty people who were more into fishing and hunting. Then there are the people who were sent there in the gulags and their offspring. There are some cities where 30-40% of the population consists of these people. Those are the people who came primarily 30s, 40s, 50s. Thereafter, a new breed of people were sent there, and these were people out to get rich quick. And rich quick means, of course, something a little bit different in the Soviet Union than it means here, but they were getting three or four times the salary that they would get elsewhere in Russia, longer vacations, and so they were going there to get money. And then there was a fourth group, and this is why the Siberians probably have a better chance to take on the new system than others, and these are the independent, free-spirited types of people who would settle in places like Alaska here. They went to Siberia to brave the elements. I was surprised how many Siberians had read Jack London. Jack London was their Bible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frederick Kemp, who is now Berlin bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. His new book, Siberian Odyssey, is based on his trip through Siberia. You went to a Stalin museum in a town where thousands died in Stalinist exile. What was the Stalin museum on?
Well, they're rewriting it now, and they're now turning it into a museum of political exile, remembering that there were also political exiles that had been sent there by Stalin. The most amazing thing was here on this place where the kulaks, these kulaks were the middle-class land-owning farmers that Stalin had to ship off, to a certain extent execute, but mainly send off to other parts to break them so he could collectivize agriculture. They settled here and died by the tens of thousands because of harsh elements and disease. In the same place that they died 20 years or 30 years before, Stalin himself had been in exile. And so the museum that was originally there was not to these people who had died at Stalin's hands, but rather to Stalin. And there was a statue there, of course, to Stalin as well, but that's been taken down. I think the thing that was chilling is in this time of Gorbachev and Glasnost, the curator of this museum was a Stalinist. And she said, look, what are we going to get out of people like Gorbachev and Yeltsin? They don't know how to lead us. What we need is the discipline and the hard work of Stalin. Look where we would have been if he hadn't been around during World War II. And you heard that. I heard that more often than made me comfortable as I traveled through Siberia.
You heard from people who were former Stalinists?
Who were not only former Stalinists,
still Stalinists. Right. Yeah.
And how anyone can be nostalgic for Stalin, knowing what they know about Stalin, boggles the mind. But there is something...
These were the people who enacted Stalin's wishes, though, aren't they?
To a certain extent, they enacted Stalin's wishes, but these are not the people who like him. It's more the simple people. The simple people are really attracted to the sort of strength that he stands for. The daughter of one of Stalin's secret police chief during the 1930s, and she was the daughter of the man who ordered the executions of the people in the mass grave that we talked about. She said, and I asked her, how can you still like Stalin? How can anyone here still like Stalin? How can you forgive your leaders for what they've done over the years? And she said, you have to say clearly what a Russian is. If a Russian is beaten up for 364 days a year, and for one day a year he's stroked, then he forgives everything else.
So what were the strokes?
Well, I think the strokes are once in a while saying, and people really believe this, once in a while saying, you are better off than the West. Yes, things are hard, but we're building this grand society. You are Russian. You are superior. Now, as long as you didn't have the information era and as long as you didn't have the glasnost under Gorbachev, people believed this. On a train going to Vorkuta, I sat beside some mountain climbers, and they were 20, 23 years old, and they recalled a time when they were in grade school when they collected rubles to send to the poor children of America. And they were very embarrassed when they told me this, and they were wondering if there were some way these rubles could be used in the United States, and they were even more disappointed when I told them that I wasn't quite sure how the rubles could be spent in the United States. But they genuinely believed that they were better off and that they were the superior system in the world. And I think that's why there's such a depth of disappointment now, is to a certain extent a feeling of betrayal.
Because they're finding out about things that had been kept from them for so many years.
Exactly. I went to the oil fields. In the area I went, Western Siberia, we ran the entire length of the Ob River. It's about the length of the Mississippi from nearly the border of Mongolia to above the Arctic Circle. About two-thirds into this trip, you hit oil country, where 60% of the country's oil reserves lie. And I talked to two of the oil pioneers. The oil fields were founded in the 1960s. And these were Komsomol members, the Communist Youth League members. They were communist leaders their whole lives. They really believed that part of the reason they were getting low salaries, part of the reason they weren't as well off, perhaps, as an oil man in Texas or anywhere else, was because they were serving the greater whole. And then, near retirement, they discover that not only are they not well off, but their country's not well off. And, of course, there's a sense of betrayal.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why there were so many prison camps in Siberia was the amount of natural resources discovered there, like coal. And Stalin needed people to mine the resources, and nobody really wanted to voluntarily move there, so people were forcibly sent there. Now, there's a lot of environmental messes in Siberia now as a result of the industrialization and the mining. What are some of the environmental problems that you saw?
I think one of the most striking things, and what I didn't expect in going to Siberia, was the beauty. It is just breathtaking. And the swamplands, who would think swamplands would be so beautiful? The largest swamplands in the world are in the northwest of Siberia, three times the size of Alaska. Three times the size of Texas. And these swamplands, which are called, they're called God's unfinished work, because the natives say this is where God forgot to separate the land from the water. And you look down on this area from above in a helicopter, and this is another one of the interesting stories. We would rent helicopters for vodka, because vodka was the most popular currency, and usually, you know, 5 to 10 bottles a day would get you a helicopter. From above, from this helicopter, you saw this epic Japanese garden. It was just gorgeous. And then you would pass areas where the oil men had been, or where they still were and oil was leaking, and you see these huge black places. And you'd see also huge brown places where the forest, the taiga, the eternal forest there, had burned down. And this had been caused, the people who were showing us around told us, partly because the oil men would leave their vodka bottles in the winter, in the snow, out in these areas. The summer would come, the sun would shine through the vodka bottle, it would act as a magnifying glass on the then dry earth, and you'd have this enormous forest fire, and they've lost a great deal of the region there. We had a Greenpeace ecologist along on our expedition, and he was saying that no one has really focused on these swamplands yet, but he believed that ultimately the damage to the swamplands could harm the environment, the ozone layer, even more than the destruction of the rainforest in Brazil.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frederick Kemp, and he's the author of the new book Siberian Odyssey, about his 5-week trip through Siberia. It's his 12th trip to the Soviet Union. He's been a foreign correspondent for Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal. He's now Berlin bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Frederick Kemp is my guest. We're talking about his new book Siberian Odyssey. Is Siberia still a place where there are a lot of prisons?
There still are a lot of prisons there. Before, it was a natural prison. Part of the reason you could send people in exile in Siberia, and this goes back to the times of Dostoevsky, is that there was no real way of getting back without dying, and so people were very safe out there in this open-air prison. There still are a large number of prisons there, partly because the infrastructure was all there. And this has caused a great problem. Gorbachev had an amnesty in 1987, and that doubled, tripled the crime problem in most of the major cities in Siberia, because most of these prisoners, once released from prison, can no longer get residency permits to return to their original place of living. And so they end up staying in Siberia. In fact, in Siberia, the organized crime problem is much larger than it is, than you would think it would be for the size of the cities. The biggest business in Kemerovo, the sort of capital of the coal area of Siberia, the Kuzbass province, one of the biggest businesses there now is steel doors, because as soon as you buy a video or a television or anything, any of the new Western goods that some people are getting access to, you can't buy one without at the same time buying a steel door to protect it against intruders.
The prisons that are in Siberia now, are they mostly for criminals? Is there any remnants of the political prisoner population?
As far as I could tell through my trip, there were no political prisoners left at all.
You visited a maximum security prison in an industrial city in Siberia. What was it like?
It was, first of all, you have to keep in mind that when you go to a place like that, you're sort of set up with the prisoners that they think will not, you know, cause you problems. It was interesting that we went on a Sunday. They've been having problems in having outsiders come into the prison. There's hostage taking and there are more escapes. They were very careful about that with me. They wanted to make sure I wasn't taken hostage, and that was the reason they said they were always with me, although I think part of it was also they wanted to make sure I wasn't told too many horror stories about what happened in the prison. But it's interesting, the whole idea of hostage taking and escape, because before, there was very little reason to escape into Soviet society, because there was very little likelihood that these people could then disappear and not be taken again. But in a new atmosphere and freedom, there's more reason to escape, so now they're facing more problems. Second problem in the prison is because there's a mafia and a sort of organized crime ring going on outside the prison, there's recruitment that goes inside the prison, and there's a new sort of boss system like we have in our own prisons. And so they now have to deal with the fact that their bosses within the prison, and they can't control the prisoners as well as they used to be able to control the prisoners.
One thing I found kind of odd, you said in the maximum security prison that you visited, there was music being piped in that sounded like, you know, Mantovani plays the Beatles, very, very music-y kind of stuff. Was there a psychological function of the music?
Yeah, I think partly there's this calming function.
God, it really irritates me. I don't know about you.
I think it would drive me to crime. But it's interesting because they now no longer have the party. Before they would say, okay, you know, this ideology is going to somehow keep you in line, and you should believe in this ideology and you should follow it. Now they have to start thinking, well, are we going to have prison chaplains? Are we going to? Is there some other goal that we're going to have to point these people toward? It was very interesting talking to the warden because he was very upset that the Communist Party had shut down and that he could no longer have party meetings with all his guards. And I said, well, why are you upset about this? And he says, well, it isn't so much the ideology. He says, you have to understand we were raised this way. We had these meetings. This was our social time. We talked to each other. People would bring problems to us. When a woman's husband was cheating on her, she would then come to the party, and the party was then to set that man straight or at least solve the problem in the couple. And he says, now I don't have any means to do that any longer.
Your trip to Siberia ended 3 weeks before the coup in the Soviet Union. Now that the Soviet Union has broken up, what's the status of Siberia? Is it an independent republic now?
No, it's still a region with various republics. It's not an independent republic itself. There is a separatist movement, people saying, let's break off Siberia. It's rich. We can do well. We don't want to carry the burden of the rest of Russia. But at the moment, that separatist movement is primarily being led by old communists who are trying to fight against Yeltsin. And I don't take it particularly seriously at this point, although the State Department is monitoring it and with some interest.
Do you think that Russia now wants to change the image of Siberia?
I think Russia would, yes, very much like to change the image of Siberia from a place of gulags to a place of riches, both of which it is. You see Western investors probably more interested in Siberia than any other place in Russia, because there you can recover the wealth more quickly than anywhere else.
Why more quickly?
Well, it's raw materials. Mm-hmm. You can get the oil out and you can sell it to the West. You don't have to worry about labor problems. You don't have to worry about setting up a plant. There's peat there in endless quantities, oil in large quantities, gold. For years, the center was telling them how they should recover the oil, and it wasn't done properly, and it wasn't changed, and they recovered it very poorly. Now they're saying the West has to teach us, so they're looking for someone new to give them guidance about how to take care of their raw materials. But on the other hand, they've been taught for so many years about how the West exploits its people with its riches that they're very nervous about turning over their raw materials, their resources, the good Russian earth, to foreign companies.
One last question for you. You've been writing for the Wall Street Journal for the past few years. Has the attitude in other countries to the Wall Street Journal changed since the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? Because I think the Wall Street Journal symbolizes capitalist newspaper, because it emphasizes business coverage and Wall Street coverage, and because Wall Street's in its title, of course. So has the attitude in former communist countries changed about your newspaper?
I was surprised how the words Wall Street could open up doors. We have been in propaganda for so long and been spoken about so negatively for so long, if not the newspaper itself, then Wall Street generally, that we have a certain credibility.
Well, Frederick Kemp, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Frederick Kemp's new book is Siberian Odyssey. Kemp is the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.